There's some history to this book, Free to Be a Family, the new one. There was a predecessor. So why don't we talk a little bit about the history and what led up to the new book?
Okay, well, about 10 years ago, or even a little more now, it's hard to believe it's that long, but it is, Marlo Thomas and a group of her friends put out a book called Free to Be You and Me, which was, you know, right at the beginning of the women's movement, actually, is when it came out. And it was a very trend-setting and important book, because it really was the first book that concentrated on doing very entertaining stories and songs and poems for kids that still didn't have kind of built-in gender stereotypes. You know, there were stories about it was okay for a boy to cry or to have a doll or for a girl to like sports, that sort of thing, but still not in a very heavy-handed way, but in a very entertaining way. And she got a lot of big stars to make a record of it, too. People like Mel Brooks and Diana Ross and Michael Jackson, who was very, very young then, but still a very good singer. They were involved in the record and in the subsequent TV special. They were all amazingly successful. I think the book sold about 500,000 to 600,000 copies in its first couple of years, and it's still in print. And the record was a gold record after a few months. And the TV special won a Peabody and an Emmy. And, you know, it's been a kind of a staple ever since. And really right after that, Marlo began to think, gee, I'd like to do some kind of sequel to that. But nobody really knew what the sequel should be. And I think really when family issues began to become so big in the last few years, Marlo began to think, gee, maybe that's the sequel we've been looking for. And she got in touch with me because she knew in the meantime that from my Sesame Street experience and publishing experience, I'd worked in television and records and books and kids things and charity things. This is all a nonprofit venture. So I seemed to be one of the few people she could find that had all the experience that she needed to work with her on this. And we got started. And again, we're doing a book and a record and a television special. And it's been very exciting. Again, we've had a really incredible number of talented contributors. And we're, you know, the book's been out a couple of months now. It reached number one on the bestseller list in the Times after a couple of weeks, which is certainly one of the biggest thrills I've ever had in publishing. And now we're working on the record and a television show. And the TV show involves some kids from America and the Soviet Union, which is another big thrill. So I'm having the time of my life with all this.
No, I bet you are. Well, the overall theme is family, and so it has family thrust. But can you be a little more specific about some of the issues that this book addresses?
Sure. Basically, our overall theme here is that that there really are lots of different kinds of families. That over the years, we've tended to have a stereotype of the word family as mom, and dad, and two little nice kids, and dad goes to work, you know. Now, that, of course, is still a lot of families are like that, but increasingly a lot aren't. We have parents with both of whom are work. We have divorced families, I'm afraid, more than we used to. You know, there are kids who are adopted who don't feel their families are quite the same. So our first goal with this really is to say no matter what your family is, it's okay. We want kids to feel that. But we also want to address, you know, specific problems that kids might have with their families or that parents might have. This is really a book for parents, too. And again, the idea is the same as with the first Free to Be project, that we want the stories to be entertaining, the songs to be nice, the poems to be fun or meaningful. We even have a comic strip in there, and all kinds of terrific people, from Kurt Vonnegut to Gloria Steinem on one hand, to most of the writers from Sesame Street, and Lily Tomlin, the Muppets. I mean, an incredible number of people have contributed. A good example of the kind of thing we would do is to try to make a kid feel good about a special family situation is that we wanted to make adopted kids, as I just mentioned, feel like their families are just as good as anybody else's and they're just as good. We tried to think of who would be a good role model for adopted kids, and we realized that Superman was indeed an adopted kid. So we went to DC Comics, and they agreed to, you know, let us do a whole comic strip about the day that Superman found out as a kid that he was adopted, and he throws a super tantrum. But one of the star illustrators from DC Comics in the old days, Carmine Infantino, who's semi-retired now, came back and drew it. And their top editor, Joe Orlando, worked on it, along with one of the top Sesame Street writers, Mark Saltzman. And the result is very funny. and I think makes its point well. It's even gotten to the point now where we're doing it on the record, and Nichols and May are playing Superman's parents. And Chris Reeve decided he would come back and play Superman for us.
When do we get to hear the record?
The record should be out, probably around April or May is what we're targeting. We may delay it a little bit more so that it coincides with the TV special we're doing, but right now it should be out in the late spring.
Well, the book is really hard to categorize because it's got a little of everything. I mean, poems, sheet music, as you mentioned, the comic strip, short stories, and some of these songs in here that are printed, I see you wrote, so you're a songwriter as well, huh?
Yes, I've actually been doing that for years, though I have a huge audience of four-year-olds because I do a lot of the rock and roll music for Sesame Street and have over the years, working with Sarah Durkee and Norman Stiles, who's the head writer. We tend to get to have a lot of the fun over there because we do the silly rock songs and parodies that are on that show all the time. And so, you know, in addition to my book writing and comedy writing, I've done a lot of that too.
Well, you're the editor. I mean, that's your title for this book. Is that correct?
That's
the
right.
Editor? So you're the one who had to, in effect, conceptualize the book and make it, I would assume, similar to the original Marlo Thomas book, but you still had to come across with the various ideas and approach the various contributors.
Right. Well, Marlo played a huge role in that, too, and so did Letty Cotton Pogrebin, who worked with Marlo in the first book and was a huge part of this one. But I was the guy day-to-day who had to make sure that all the ideas we wanted got done. Actually, Marlo and Letty and I and others spent a lot of time before we started thinking of all the themes that we thought might be important, and we went up to Bank Street School and talked to some experts there, and all around the country we talked to experts on child abuse, all of this, because we wanted to think of all the family issues that might not be touched in an ordinary kids or family book. And adoption, as I've mentioned, was one. Child abuse was another. Single parents, working parents, divorce. And we tried to say, we actually made up a whole list of all these things, and then we began to approach the writers that we thought would be good at this. I mentioned the Sesame Street people because they're used to doing comedy things with a theme for kids, with education kind of buried in it. But we also approached a lot of our favorite adult writers that we thought could write for kids. We approached songwriters like Carly Simon and Jay.
And you, in effect, gave them an assignment.
Well, yeah, though we kind of worked out the assignments together. We'd go over the list of themes and say, do any of these interest you? And quite often, we were lucky, you know, that not everyone picked the same ones. And we ended up covering just about everything that we wanted to cover. Then at the end, we started doing assignments. We realized we needed something more about the world family or about pollution or, you know, that your community is kind of a family, too. So then we would think, now, gee, who could write that? And we'd fill in that way.
Well, it's really a pretty book, and it's a very interesting book because you don't really... I know about the original Marlo Thomas book. I never read it, but I know that it caused an enormous impact, especially with the follow-up television version and the record version. But I have never quite seen a book that encompasses all of these various things like that. Maybe there has been a prototype for something like this before outside of the original Marlo Thomas book, but I haven't seen anything like that before.
What really happens with a project like this that's so exciting is that, you know, once you begin to get it going, you just keep saying, well, gee, let's try this now, or let's try that now, let's ask this person, and it just keeps building. We realized early that one of the things that we might do is try to get absolutely the top kids illustrators and graphic designers to work with us. We said, why not get the illustrations to be as beautiful as the stories? And sure enough, Bantam went along with us and allowed us to do the whole book in full color, and they've just been great to work with. So we approached a lot of the people who've won the Caldecott Awards for the best art. Leo and Diane Dillon in particular, who won 2 years in a row, illustrated a story in here that Ann Cameron, she wrote something else, I get it mixed up, Mavis Jukes, who's another kids award winning writer, they work together, and they really produce one of the most beautiful things in the book, a story called Cross Your Fingers. And Arnold Lobel, who unfortunately just died recently, but we have his art in here. Shel Silverstein, who's certainly one of the best kids illustrators and writers, has pieces in here. So it was a chance to work with some of the people I've always idolized, a few of them I was lucky enough to know already. But when you have a project like this, you can call all kinds of people that you've always wanted to meet. And that's been part of the thrill for me. Marlo called all her friends, like Whoopi Goldberg and Mel Brooks. They're all involved again. It's just, you know, staggering who we got. And, you know, to me, the challenge was keeping it all straight, getting it all done, and making sure it fit together. And, as you know, Don, I'm a computer nut. And we kept a lot of it straight, all the different rewrites and what was due and when it was due and all the billings and all of that. We kept really on an office Macintosh, and it kept us straight the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me a little bit about Christopher Cerf. Now, you mentioned an office Macintosh, and you mentioned your own office environment and this sort of thing. You have kind of an unusual occupation in a way. I mean, you're not considered just a writer or something. So tell me, what you have a business. Tell me about
it. I do. Well, it's hard for me to divide business, pleasure, and creativity, and I think that describes what I do. I never can say it very quickly, but maybe this will help. But I like to write a lot. I like editing. I like putting things together, producing in a sense. And I like to work in a lot of different media. I'm interested in music. And I like to work with people that, you know, can do some of those things even better than I can. So I'm interested in humor, and I'm interested in education. And over the years, I found different ways of putting all that together, whether it's a satiric book, it still will try to make a point. And we did a show with you about a year ago on a book called The Pentagon Catalog, where we wanted to let people know specific things about Pentagon overspending, but we used satire to do it, but all the facts were in there. In this case, we had a goal of really, you know, helping kids with these family issues and also raising money, I might add, for family issues, because, as I said, the Free to Be Foundation gets all the funds and distributes them for causes like hunger and homelessness and various family issues. So, again, this seemed like something that combined the kinds of things I like to do, writing, editing, humor, music.
But you've actually formed a corporation.
Yeah, I have a little company called Christopher Cerf Associates, which is really just a few people. But there are many people that I work with on a lot of things. Sarah Durkee, who has a lot of songs and stories in this book and writes for Sesame Street also. But we've done educational films together for Children's TV Workshop. A lot of my work involves Sesame Street, which is another example of this kind of thing. I guess when people want to do things in more than one medium, or if they want to do things that have a serious purpose but are lighthearted in style, or if they want to do satire in several media, I would like them to think of me, and I think quite often they do. And I hate to work on things if they don't have a few of those aspects, if they're too serious, or if they don't have a real serious meaning behind them, or if they're not funny enough, or, you know, it's hard to say. But the ideal project for me is one like this that involves music and writing and editing and some fun and doing some good. You know, you can't ask for much more than that.
Yeah.
And especially if you know, that's what you call your work day. I just have a wonderful, wonderful time, and I work with some delightful people on all these things.
Well, you look like a guy who enjoys himself.
I sure do.
Well, there's one thing that perhaps the listener doesn't know about you, that you are the son of the late Bennett Cerf, the legendary publisher and founder of Random House. So you got off probably to a very early literary start with that kind of household. Tell me a little bit what it was like growing up as a son of Bennett Cerf.
Well, it was absolutely great. I think it's only later that you realize how special it was, because it just seemed natural to me that William Faulkner would come for dinner or John O'Hara would come for dinner. But there were always wonderful writers around. And, you know, they just seemed like the people we knew. As I got to be a teenager, did I say, my gosh, this is kind of special. And my dad was very easygoing, but in a subtle way, he really was teaching me publishing all the time. He said, I don't care if you go into the media or not, but if you don't, I'll kill you. That was the way he usually put it. And I always wanted to do it. And he had boundless energy, and he didn't draw those lines between, you know, publishing or television either. And, you know, when I went to school, everyone said, gee, Chris, you're going to have to choose. You're either going to be a songwriter, or you're going to work in television, or you're going to work in publishing. And my dad, I think, shared the view with me that they're all kind of the same thing. They all involve writing or creativity or design.
Yeah, and I remember reading some really clever books that he wrote. They were anecdotes.
Right.
I can't remember all the names.
Well, Try and Stop Me was one. Shake Well Before Using.
I did. And he wrote his memoirs at random.
At random, right.
At random. He's been on What's My Line?
Sure, for years.
He developed the Modern Library, didn't he?
Well, he didn't develop it, but that's how he got started in publishing.
He bought it, right.
He and his partner, Donald Klopfer, bought it, suddenly the name escapes me. Oh, Horace Liveright was the publisher that they worked with, and he was doing a lot of show production, and he needed some money to Liverite needed some money to fund one of his shows, so he decided to sell the Modern Library, and my dad and Donald were right there and said, this is our shot. And that was a hardcover reprint series, of course, before there were paperbacks. And they bought that, and for a few years they published just those Modern Library books. And then Donald and my dad said, gee, we ought to publish a few extra books a year at random. That was where the name Random House came from. And they got Rockwell Kent, who was a famous artist of that time, to design their little Random House logo and put that on their first few books. And lo and behold, they had a publishing company.
Yeah, just like you. He was a multimedia guy, wasn't he?
Well, he really was.
And Random House developed into a major publishing house, too. It started off slowly, but it's way up there. I mean, just a little below maybe Simon & Schuster, but it's...
Well, it's right up there. It's certainly one of the biggest now because it's merged over the years with Knopf and Pantheon and Ballantine. They have all kinds of different lines of...
Well, when you were growing up, your father, would he come to you with a new book that he was publishing and say, here, Chris, read this?
Yeah, he really would. And, you know, it was a big thrill when you could occasionally help him in some way. He used to do anthologies of short stories that he would edit as well as publish. And he didn't know science fiction, and I used to love it as a kid. So he would always have me find a science fiction story for him. And a couple of times he used them in his books. And that was an incredible thrill for someone who was 13, 14, and had aspirations in publishing, and also just wanted Dad to like me, you know, so he would be proud. It would make me feel great. And I, you know, I would help him when I could, but I don't think he needed a whole lot of help from me.
No, he was doing okay. Where did you go to school?
I went to Harvard, was where I went to college. And
what did you study?
English. Mm-hmm. But I really studied the Harvard Lampoon. That's what I did most of my time. And, we worked there on a lot of multimedia things even then when I was at the Lampoon. We were lucky enough to get an offer from Mademoiselle magazine while I was on the Lampoon to parody themselves. This is very unusual, but there was an amazing woman there named Betsy Talbot Blackwell, and she knew that her July issue was always in the doldrums at Mademoiselle because it was in between fashion periods and they never sold any advertising. So she decided... What the heck? The Lampoon, Harvard Lampoon, is famous for its magazine parodies. So they actually brought all of us kids down to New York to put their issue out for them. And that was an amazing experience for me in publishing. I learned so much from that. You know, they turned over their offices and their models to us. We had a great time. And we also did a couple of books and a record while I was there. It was a great learning experience. It was a great way to leap right into media as soon as I got out of college.
Well, yeah, it was a great way to start. And... Well, listen, Christopher, it was great having you in and talking to you again. I hope we continue to stay in touch. Free to Be Family has done all right for itself. It's been out for some time, and it looks like it's going to stay in the bookstores for a long time to come.
Right.
And probably as the record comes out and the television version comes out, each one will play off the other. So
well, that's certainly the hope.
A long-running book, so to speak.
Well, we think so. You know, it's sold about 500,000 copies already, which amazes me. I never expected that much at this stage. But we're hoping to go right on.
Mr. Frizer, thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you.